When I was leading church youth groups back in the early 2000s, I would occasionally issue them copies of a mostly blank journal assembled by Linda Krantz, which was called Through My Eyes, in which each page had a question or two, and then the rest of it was just the blank page. It asked questions like, if you could start today over, what would you do differently? What makes you happy? If you could change three things about yourself, appearance, personality, or something else, what would they be and why? And how would you go about making those changes? One page asked the questions, are you open-minded to other people's opinions? Do you listen to all sides before you respond? Paul wrote to the fractious church in Rome, why do you pass judgment on your brother or sister? Or you, why do you despise your brother or sister? For we will all stand before the judgment seat of God. Some were coming in and some were coming back into the church with ideas about faithful practice that were diametrically opposed to other people's ideas about what made for the most faithful practice. Suzanne McCaskill told me a long time ago that a dear close friend of hers had mentioned that she worried because now they were going to two different churches in a close area and just kind of worried about what would happen to them. And Suzanne said, something? I like strawberry ice cream. You like vanilla. And of course, as they should, they have remained good, close, personal friends. Paul said, okay, some of you say this based on your faith, and some of you say something different, also based on your sincere desire to be faithful to God. Great. You like strawberry? You like vanilla? This is a very different thing, by the way, from saying that there are no right or wrong answers. It's true that sometimes more than one argument, angle, or perspective can be right. It's also true that somebody can be wrong and can still be an entirely worthy human being. And it is most definitely true that we have all been wrong a lot in our lives, morally, factually, ethically, and in 100 other ways. And yet we are all still made in the image of God. We are all still animated by the Holy Spirit. We are all still redeemed by the cross. And God still loves and forgives and instructs disciples to do the same in no uncertain terms. Miller Williams had a great line in a poem called Compassion. Have compassion for everyone you meet, even if they don't want it. What seems conceit, bad manners, or cynicism is always a sign of things no ears have heard, no eyes have seen. You do not know what wars are going on down there where the spirit meets the bone. One of the countless gifts of being the church is not only to realize, but to bask in the beautiful truth that the people around us are flawed humans too, just like me. They have their own wars going on. And their responses to those journal questions might look very different from mine in ways that I probably can't even imagine. More questions from that journal for teenagers. Complete this sentence. You don't know how difficult it was when. Write about what you have learned over the last year. How have you changed or grown as a person? Write about your saddest day and how you made it through that most difficult time. Speaking of youth groups, back in the late 1990s, when I was bringing groups here to the Montreat Youth Conference, the church I was serving had seen what a powerful thing the youth conference was, and that it looked like a lot of fun for the young people, but it was also entirely evident to them that it was spiritually deep, rigorous, and intensive. I had developed a list as the youth director of 6 criteria that were used to decide whether someone was eligible to come with our group. And the young people and their parents knew this from day one, when, as soon as they came into the group. This was a year-round focus, so people always knew this is what we're looking at. Attitude was one. Is this somebody that other people can live with in close quarters for a week? Responsibility was one. There was going to be an awful lot of time during the day when young people would sort of be on their own. We had to have absolute confidence that they were going to be where they needed to be. And a few others, I can't remember all of them, but during the year, did they participate in the opportunities that we gave them to help other people in the church and in the wider community? One night I went over all 6 of these criteria with the session of that church, and one of the elders said, I don't know if I could live up to those criteria. I don't know if anybody in this room could live up to those criteria. And I said, yeah. I said, our young people can. They do every year. And so can we. Sure we can. Of course we can. And one of the ways we do it is to recognize that we're all going to fall short sometimes, we're all going to make mistakes, and we can help each other by being open to forgiveness, giving it and receiving it. And sometimes we will have perspectives that don't align with each other, so all the more we can help each other out by giving each other a break. And we can listen, especially when somebody says or does something that I don't agree with. Where are they coming from? Why would they think that or say what they said? The church is a place where we can be human beings together. And even when the place is not available, the church is still a reality in which we are human beings together. All made in God's image, all coming with our own individual relationships with God, each bringing our own personality. Doesn't mean I have to open up with people all the time if I'm an introvert, and it doesn't mean I have to isolate myself in contemplation for weeks at a time if I'm an extrovert who feels like I'm supposed to be like the introverts. It means I understand that faithful people sometimes see and react to things differently and come to differing conclusions about what is faithful. The point here for Paul is that all of this is taking place among people who are trying their best to be faithful, faithful to God and to each other and to themselves. And who is any one of us to judge? David Brooks recently wrote, to accurately size up a human situation, you have to project a certain quality of attention that is personal, gentle, respectful, intimate, and affectionate, more moving with and feeling into than simply observing with detachment. He said, maybe I spend too much time on Twitter and in media, but I see less and less of this sort of attention in America, even amid the tragedies of 2020. Far from softening toward one another, the whole country feels even more riven, more hardened, and increasingly blind to lives other than our own. Seth Godin, who has a highly respected business blog, wrote just this week, musing about the honest mistake versus the intentional act. He said, even though the harm may be the same, talking about an intentional act or an honest mistake, even though the harm may be the same, we're much more likely to move on from an acknowledged accidental mistake. Is it because We know that we've made honest mistakes ourselves, and the act of forgiving the other person is a way of forgiving ourselves. The gospel reading from Matthew, where Jesus tells a parable about forgiveness using slave and owner metaphors, lands awkwardly on our ears, to put it mildly. Sometimes I imagine if I were a public relations manager for Jesus, and I think it's important, by the way, for all of us to think about the ways in which we are and are not Jesus's PR people. On the one hand, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. Okay, sign me up if that's being a PR person for Jesus. On the other hand, Jesus doesn't need us to edit or correct him or to figure out what the Gospels really meant to say and then fix it and spin it. But anyway, if I thought I were a public relations manager for Jesus and I heard him say what he just said, that parable about slaves and a God who acts in spite and rage, I can at least imagine myself saying, I have a couple of notes. First of all, I understand that slavery was a fundamentally different phenomenon in your context than the subhuman atrocity that we know it as. In your story, a slave being in a position to loan another slave 100 denarii, essentially 100 days' worth of wages, it makes that fairly clear. But as far as telling this parable just like this, maybe not right now. And the thing at the end there about the unforgiving slave being sent to prison and tortured, and how you said that's what God would do to people, your people specifically, who fail to forgive. Did you mean it exactly that way? Because if you didn't mean it, I wish you wouldn't have said it. And if you do mean it, I really wish you wouldn't have said it. Because it sounded like you just said that God is a slave owner who reacts in raw anger with violent and retributive violence against people, such as errant slaves who fail or even just forget to forgive other errant slaves, being handed over to be tortured as a result of God's uncontrollable rage. And I frankly don't believe that God addresses the human failure to forgive by being even less forgiving, enforcing it with the overwhelming might of a great power and the willing participation of committed jailers and torturers. I find it hard to believe because I have seen and experienced God's grace, love, and mercy, as well as God's justice. And I'd want to say, aren't you afraid, Jesus, that since you said that when the mics were hot, this is not going to be a very good news cycle for us? At which point, I imagine Jesus may or may not look at me for a few seconds and then get up and go with his entourage to the region of Judea beyond the Jordan, with large crowds following him. And there he would heal them, which is exactly what happens in Matthew's gospel. Leaving me to think, well, I'll figure it out later and maybe ask him again what he meant. But in the meantime, obviously it's hugely important to God that I start participating in both sides of forgiveness and encouraging others to do the same. Like it's urgent and the time is now. And according to Jesus, it's hard to imagine anything being more crucial to who we are and who God means for us to be. Built into a sheer mountainside in northern Italy is a church called the Sanctuary of Madonna della Corona. In the early 1500s, it was a hermitage, and for centuries it was only accessible by foot up a long, long walkway up the side of the mountain. It is breathtakingly steep. It appears to be literally a part of the mountainside itself. To look out its windows would be to see a vast panorama of God's creation. To look directly down from a window would be the kind of thing that I have nightmares about. It literally just looks like it's built on the as part of the side of these very steep cliffs. But even back when the generations who could have known Jesus of Nazareth personally were forming the very foundations of the church, even then, Paul already knew that it was always perched on a precipice. And yet, even in those early days, the gathering of disciples into one church inspired awe and wonder and provided vistas of breathtaking beauty and announced by its very existence that in God and in each other, we have been given the greatest gifts imaginable. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors.